All right, thank you. You may be seated. This case is called Oasis Legal Finance Group and Others versus Cynthia Kaufman in her capacity as the Attorney General. May I have the introductory reasons for this, counsel?
Good morning, Jason Dunn. On behalf of Oasis Legal Finance, plaintiff Clemens Holden, before voting in the courtroom today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Fred Yarger, Solicitor General, on behalf of General Kaufman and the Uniform Consumer Credit Administrator.
Very good. Gentlemen, this is a one-hour case. That means each side has a half an hour. So, Mr. Dunn, go ahead and whenever you're ready, you'll need to keep track of your own time if you wish to say something for anybody.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether the purchase and sale of potential proceeds from a personal injury claim is a loan under the Colorado Uniform Consumer Credit Code. The Uniform Consumer Credit Code defines the loan as, quote, the creation of debt by the lender's payment of or agreement to pay money to another party. Thus, the key question in this case is, what does it mean to create debt? Since this court's decision in Shields versus Ludlum in 1923, where the court describing debt through the maxim that nothing is my debt unless a judgment for its amount can be enforced against me, through the court's more recent decision in Salazar v. Cashnow, this court has defined how debt is created. Under that definition, the purchase and sale of litigation proceeds does not create debt and is not a loan under the UCCC. What I'd like to do is talk about the Cashnow case and then discuss both the definitions provided by the Court of Appeals and the administrator with regard to debt and loan. And then if I have time at the end to talk about the administrator's argument that the transactions here are non-recourse secured loans. In the Cashnow case, of course, the agreements in that case involved the purchase and sale of anticipated income tax refunds from individuals. Under the terms of those agreements relevant here, the seller of the tax refund was personally obligated to make up any shortfall or the entirety of the amount if the government failed to pay to the purchaser the anticipated tax refund. In that case, the Court of Appeals looked at the consensus of usury case law from around the country and concluded that they were not loans because the usual rule that a loan requires an absolute obligation on behalf of the borrower. So the question for this court in that case was whether or not the Court of Appeals had interpreted a loan too narrowly to require that absolute obligation under the UCCC. And of course, the Supreme Court said yes, the loan can include a conditional obligation of repayment. But it's how the court got to that conclusion that is what is instructive in this case. First, of course, the court said that there was no express requirement in the UCCC that there be an absolute obligation of repayment. But second, the court relied on the South Carolina decision in income tax filers v. Ham. Quoting Ham, the Supreme Court said that in the context of purchase and sale agreements, where a conditional obligation of repayment gives the lender or the buyer a recourse against the borrower or the seller, in the event that the asset purchased fails to have the anticipated value, the lender no longer views the asset as a chosen action, quote, because the borrower owes it a sum of money, whether the refund or chose is valuable to the lender or not. This is debt, the court said. In other words, because the seller of the tax refund had a conditional obligation of repayment, the buyer was guaranteed to be repaid from one source or another, and thus viewed the transaction simply as a loan that would be eventually repaid. That's the definition of debt in Colorado, and from the lesson we learned from Cashnow. And absent that absolute right to be repaid, there is no debt and there is no loan. Here, that critical element, that conditional obligation of repayment that triggered the absolute right to be repaid, in Cashnow was absent. Oasis and Lawcash purchased small portions of potential proceeds of the personal injury claim and agreed that if the proceeds are less than anticipated, the seller owes nothing. It is a present transfer of what is well established at law as an asset. And the buyer receives only what the asset is worth upon settlement or judgment of the case, if anything. These contracts are fairly high risk for the companies. As we cite in the brief, OASIS reports that in nearly half the cases, they received back less than the contracted amount. In nearly a quarter of the cases, they received back only their original investment or less. And in 10% of the cases, they actually received nothing at all, either because of the tort plaintiff chose not to proceed with their case, or because they lost at trial, or because the settlement amount is less than sufficient to cover any medical needs or contingent attorney fees and leave any funds remaining that would be transferred to the buyer. But the key point is that in contrast to the facts in cash now, here there is no conditional obligation of repayment that establishes that right to be repaid in the buyer. Thus, there's no debt here, there's no loan.
Counsel, may I interrupt? Is this structure unique in Colorado, or is this widespread across the country? I'm curious with respect to the no obligation on behalf of the seller, as you describe it, to repay any of the money loaned to that seller.
Sure, if I understand your question.
I'm mixing everyone's terminology here.
Sure. Yes, I think there is an industry that's been around for quite some time. Both these companies have been doing business in Colorado for more than 10 years. All I might add, without a single complaint to the Attorney General's office that I'm aware of. So yes, that's traditionally the way the transactions are structured. It's a purchase of an asset. I think it's, as I said, it's well established that these claims, or excuse me, these proceeds are assets. They purchase them with no recourse to the seller, so that person can gain immediate funds, or typically small amounts. In the case of my clients, they're generally, I think as we cite in our brief, they average $1,500 they're used for household needs. Importantly, they're not used to fund litigation. There is another industry that does that, but the funds are not paid to the attorneys or used for the cost of litigation.
Right, and I guess I was just asking if there are other companies that structure their transactions more along the line of the cash now arrangement as opposed to this arrangement.
I'm not aware of it.
Okay, so typically this is an industry standard?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
As far as I'm aware.
Mr. Dunn, is there a threshold concern here about the enforceability of these types of agreements in the wake of the Allstate medical lien management case that we need to address?
I would answer that a couple of ways, Justice Hood. First, I did read that case, and while it says that the assignment of personal injury proceeds has not, that question has not been directly answered, I would answer, number one, I think Cashnow did answer that. In Cashnow, the court repeatedly refers to the assignment of the right to receive the tax refunds. I would suggest that the majority rule throughout the country is that the assignment of personal injury proceeds are assignable. And I would note that the administrator in this case did not question whether the assignment was valid, but rather whether it was a loan under the UCCC. So despite the court's clear articulation of the definition of what constitutes debt in cash now, the Court of Appeals and to, I think even a greater extent, the administrator offer definitions that are not only in conflict with that, but the definition in cash now, but really are unprecedented and sweeping in scope. Let me talk first about the Court of Appeals definition. So the Court of Appeals rely principally on Black's Law Dictionary to define debt as a specific sum of money due by agreement or otherwise. And then the court, somewhat in a conclusory manner, said debt includes contingent debt, and defined that term as the debt not presently fixed, but that may become fixed at some future date upon the occurrence of some other. Thus, under the Court of Appeals articulation, and any agreement, whether it's under the UCCC or not, that might create debt in the future is a debt today at the time of contract. First, the Court of Appeals simply conflates the concept of contingent debt and debt. They are two distinct concepts. Contingent debt simply is not debt. I think of it as a provision in a contract that might at some point in the future trigger a debt, but it is not, at the time the contract is formed, a debt. Second, the Court of Appeals definition, if applied literally, would create profound implications for a limitless number of other contracts and asset transfer agreements that would now be debts and possibly loans if they met the other criteria of the UCCC. So take, for example, an equity investment. If I invest in a company And the owner of that company agrees that at a future date, if certain performance metrics are met, they will return my investment plus some return. Under the Court of Appeals interpretation, that is a debt on the part of the owner of the company today, not once the performance metrics is met, it triggers the debt, but today. Contingent legal fees. That creates a debt under this definition in the client. The client receives legal services today, and if they are successful in settlement or litigation, and it triggers an obligation to their attorney under their fee agreement, that would be a debt today. Even common waivers, as we say in our brief. If I make a bet with somebody and bet $10 that tomorrow will rain, and if it does, they owe me $20, the rain happening is not the triggering event under the court's definition that creates the debt. It's the debt today under the contract. And that has a variety of ramifications. The most obvious is which under IRS law, the forgiveness of debt is a taxable event and it has to be reported as ordinary income. So in every case in which either the wager is lost or the equity investment is lost, that would trigger a reportable event with the IRS and result in taxes. Finally, I think, and most relevant here, the Court of Appeals definition is simply the first court in the country to hold that the purchase and sale of litigation proceeds to be a debt under the Uniform Consumer Credit Code. Notably, I think the administrator seems to recognize the problems with the Court of Appeals definition as it seems that they don't put up much of a defense in their brief to the Court of Appeals definition. Nor offer a definition of her own to what it means to create debt under the UCCC. Rather, the administrator really suggests that a loan should be defined as any advance of money, presumably even where no affirmative obligation exists to repay that advance from any source. That definition fails for three reasons. First, the UCCC already has a definition of loan, as I've talked about. Second, that definition is simply unprecedented. In the 10 other states that have adopted the Uniform Code, none has applied such a definition, and the administrator has cited no authority other than cash now for that definition. Instead, the administrator relies primarily on two UCC cases, UCCC cases, and one regulatory opinion from one of those states. Real quickly, the two cases, one is from the Kansas Supreme Court, the Decision Point case, and that involved the sale by real estate agents of their commissions once a sale had transpired on a home or a real estate property, and they were selling those commissions at a discount and presumably then to repay that in the future when the real estate transaction is closed and they receive their commission. But how that case is distinguishable is the fact that the real estate agents in that case, the borrower, had personal recourse, and they had a personal obligation to repay. So in that case, there were actually a variety of recourse options for the buyer. I believe they could cancel the contract and get back the original amount, and put a lien on future commissions, and I think that's a couple other options. So as opposed to the case here where there is no personal obligation on the part of the supposed borrower, in that case, clearly there was. The other case is out of Oklahoma, again, a new UCCC state, and the Apple Auto case. That's a case involving sale and leaseback transactions. So a person goes to the company, they sell their car at a large discount for market value. The company would then lease the car back to the person, and I believe the way it works is that at the end of that time, the person had the option to repurchase the vehicle at their original price, and therefore the lease payments were the equivalent of interest in that scenario. And from the perspective of the borrower, they knew they were going to get repaid one way or the other. Either they would get the interest and then purchase at the end and make their profit, or they would simply take the vehicle that they purchased at a substantial discount to market and be able to sell that. But in either case, neither are obviously litigation proceed cases, and both involve at least conditional, if not absolute, obligations of repayment. And the other, I think, substantial authority they cite is simply a regulatory opinion also from Kansas by the banking commissioner there, where transactions similar to those that issue here were discussed. And the staff attorney who wrote the letter in that opinion I think really all they, first of all, they relied on the decision point case. So they really looked at it from a perspective of an absolute obligation, whether the transaction's here or whether the law required an absolute obligation of repayment. And they said, well, it doesn't. So therefore, these are loans. And they skipped the intermediate steps about whether or not at least a contingent obligation was required, or whether situations such as here where there's no obligation, it could be a loan. If you look at the non-UCCC states, again, no statutes or cases adopting such a broad definition as the administrator suggests here. In fact, the cases overwhelmingly hold that the purchase of litigation proceeds is not a loan. And if you look at the cases outside of UCCC that don't involve litigation funding but are looking at the context of what is a loan, they overwhelmingly support the rule that loans require at least an absolute obligation of repayment in most cases, and if not, a contingent obligation of repayment. In contrast, the administrator relies primarily on three litigation funding cases. The one that is discussed the most, I think, is referenced by the Court of Appeals is the Avail versus LegalBox case. That was a case out of the Intermediate Court of Appeals in North Carolina. And the issue there was whether or not litigation funding agreements were usurious under their state usury statute. And while they were found to be usurious, the key distinction in that case versus Colorado is that the law in North Carolina, again, not a UCCC state, defined what would be usury as including any loan or an advance. And they had some other obligations like a forbearance. But the court clearly said, well, these aren't loans because there's no obligation of repayment, but they could be an advance under that statute and therefore held them to be usurious. Different than what the UCCC requires here. The administrator cites two other cases, the Echeverria case, which was simply a New York trial court opinion, actually did not involve the purchaser in that case. It was that involved only the injured party and their employer. And that was an opinion where the trial court took it upon itself to opine on what he thought of these transactions. Since then, that case has not been followed. In fact, there's a case, Kelly versus Quick Cash, which is another New York trial court case, which held the exact opposite, that the transactions are valid purchase and sale agreements. And I think to put a finer point on it, there has been no prohibition as a result of the Echeverria case in New York on any of these kind of transactions. And lastly, the administrator cites the Ransom case, which is an Ohio intermediate appellate decision. That case was actually reversed by the Ohio State Supreme Court on other grounds.
Mr. Dunkley, interrupt you there. Sure. Good morning. Let me kind of cut to the chase of where I have an issue. Your argument is that this is an investment and not a loan, correct?
Yes, it's a purchase and sale, and arguably the purchaser views as an investment.
So I guess backing up a little bit, then if it's not a loan, then what is it? Is it an investment or what is it?
Sure, it's an investment and it's a purchase. It's a purchase of an asset.
Okay, so most times when you have an investment in a business, you get money based on what the people earn. So if the company makes 10%, then you get a 10% return on your investment, correct? Yes?
That's one description. Okay, sure.
The issue that I have in this case, with that background, is that the multiplier in this is time, not how the person does. And so that seems to me to be more of a loan than it does an investment. Can you comment?
Sure. So I'll answer that two ways. First, I think, and your comment made me think of one of the amicus briefs where they talk about that investments are typically investments in the efforts of others. That's not incorrect, but it's simply too narrow. I'll give you an example of shorting a stock. I might short a stock because I think the company is going to not do well and it's going to fail. I make money off that. No one will question whether that's an investment. Second, I would say that with regard to the time factor, my understanding of venture capital and equity investments is that often they are trying to time. So someone might say, I'll invest in your company, and if it takes a year for you to sell your company, then I want 10% return. If it takes 2 years, I want 20% or whatever. And then time, all that does is really recognize opportunity cost, it recognizes risk, and represent it, it reflects the time value of the money. It's just another way of valuing those aspects of the agreement.
But in the example that you gave, that interest rate remains the same, basically. You said 1 year, 10%, 2 years, 20%. But in this case, it increases the longer, the interest rate increases the longer that they have the money, correct? It's an acceleration.
Well, first, I would not describe it as an interest rate because it is a purchase. But again, the example I use, I would say the interest rate does not stay the same. So you might say, look, I get 10% of your company if you sell it in the first year. If you sell it in 5 years, I get 40%. So those are different rates of return on the investment, and that happens very regularly, I think, in the equity and venture capital world.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
Like the Court of Appeals definition of debt, the administrator's definition of loan, I think, will snare up a limitless number of other transactions. I talked about the contingent legal fees and equity investments. But with regard to the definition of loan, I think there's some other statutory transactions that will also be encompassed by the definition of loan. Those were talked about in the medical lien management case specifically. So contracts to sell, viaticals, insurance proceeds, structured settlements, medical malpractice settlements, and lottery annuities. Those are all contracts and transactions that are authorized by statute that are not loans, presumably not loans, because they're not governed by the administrator, but that would be under this definition of loan as an advance of money. Right? So if I do take the lottery example, if I win the lottery and it's an annuity payment over 20 years, I like sell that annuity stream to someone in return for a present payment. That's regulated by statute, and you have to go to the court, as you all know, for your recent decision and have that approved. But there is no statutory guidelines on disclosures or rate caps or anything like that. Arguably, under the administrator's definition, all those types of transactions would now be loans. And if they're loans, then of course, and they qualify for the UCCC if they're for personal, family, or household use, and they're less than $75,000, then they're subject to the UCCC, and they're subject to all the requirements, and the purchaser of those assets have to be licensed under state law and subject to regulation by the administrator. And what's most ironic about that outcome is that one of the fundamental aspects of what distinguishes loans from investments often is risk. And if you look at all those type of statutory agreements, they're all almost guaranteed return, right? If you win the lottery and you sell off that stream, the obligor is the state government, or in the other cases, it's an insurance company.
Well, doesn't this look like a lot like a predatory practice on a vulnerable consumer population?
I would disagree with that, Justice Hobbs.
Why not?
They're
well, we have to carry out the intent of the General Assembly, and it seems that that is part of the consumer protection intent, is it not?
I would agree that part of the intent of the UCCC is to provide consumer protection, sure. You have consumers in this situation who have an injury. That injury is the way I view it, is an accrued asset. They have lost some sort of economic value. And they have to decide what to do with that asset while they're trying to figure out what happens with their case. And remember, in all these cases, they're required to have an attorney in all these contracts. So their attorney can review this agreement, they can advise them whether to do it or not, and the companies have no influence over the litigation. But they're usually for small amounts, as we cite in our brief, and I think I mentioned a moment ago, they're usually for small amounts for typically just routine household things, so paying the car payment, paying the mortgage, putting food on the table, tuition, those kind of things, is what their consumers say that they use this money for. Someone raised a good point to me the other day that I think put a final point on that. One of the options someone always have, I'm not a personal injury lawyer, but as I understand it, they always have an option to accept a initial low offer from the insurance company. And presumably, when they enter into these transactions, they're choosing not to do that because they think that's a smart economic decision. Rather than accept a low-ball offer today, I can make sure I get my rent paid and my car payment made, and that will allow me time to pursue a higher settlement or a full litigation of my case. So I would argue that that the consumers benefit from this. Let me turn quickly to the argument of the administration that these are simply non-recourse secured loans like PON. They spend a lot of time in their brief arguing that it's analogous to a PON. So what is a PON? A PON is a transaction where an individual goes into the pawn shop, say they have a lot that's valued at $1,000, and they want to pawn that. So they will enter into a contract with the pawn broker. They will receive, say, a fraction of that amount. These contracts are typically structured so that the amount they receive is no more than probably a third of the value of the product. Say in this case, $300 for the $1,000 watch. The way the contract works is they have the right to either cancel that contract at a premium, so say in this case $500 within 30 days, or the right to just simply, they structure it as a repurchase back of their own watch at $500. So the pawn broker in that case would make $200. But the reason pawns are distinct from the transactions here, of course, is that from the perspective of the borrower, or excuse me, the lender or the purchaser, they have an absolute right to be repaid in the pawn context. Either the owner of the watch is going to cancel or the contract at a higher price or repurchase the watch at a higher price, and the pawn broker makes this $200. Or if they decide not to exercise that option, then of course the pawn broker has no watch and can sell it at $1,000. And the courts, in reviewing pawn cases, have actually described that disparity between the incentive to repurchase it at a lower price than its market value as such a strong incentive that it really constitutes an obligation to repay the loan. And of course, in our situation, there's not that case. At the moment that the agreement is signed, the asset transfers, and the seller of the asset is out of the picture. With a few minutes left, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel? Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. Petitioners and companies like them are in the business of paying money to consumers who need that money immediately for personal household use. In return, petitioners require their customers to sign contracts obligating them to repay not only the principal amount, but additional amounts that grow over time out of the proceeds of a lawsuit settlement or tort judgment. The interest rates for these transactions can exceed 200%, well in excess of the UCCC's limits. That means that a consumer that borrows $3,000 could, 2 years later, owe upwards of $15,000. Now the question in this case is whether these transactions should be subject to the same consumer protection and disclosure rules that govern pawns, payday loans, tax refund and anticipation loans, and other high-interest consumer credit transactions in the state of Colorado. Because they satisfy the definition, the broad definition of loan under the UCCC, they are subject to the rules. Now, petitioner's position in this case is that they should be exempt from regulation under the UCCC because, in their view, the UCCC categorically excludes loans that include non-recourse features. For three reasons, the District Court and the Court of Appeals were correct to reject this limitation on the UCCC and correct to reject this invitation to draft into the UCCC a blueprint for avoiding regulation. Excuse me. First, a restriction based on recourse is found nowhere within the UCCC itself. The definitions of loan and consumer loan under the UCCC are broad and inclusive, not rigid or technical. They do not depend on specific repayment terms, and they do not depend on the notion of recourse. Second, the code explicitly contemplates non-recourse loans in at least three ways. First, pawns, which are perhaps the most recognizable consumer non-recourse loan. Another example is reverse mortgages, which are specifically mentioned in the definition of consumer loan, but like other loans secured by real estate, are carved out from the UCCC and regulated elsewhere. Other statutes in the state of Colorado define these loans as non-recourse loans secured by an interest in real estate. Finally, the code actually prohibits recourse under certain circumstances when it comes to consumer credit sales. So petitioner's assertion in the briefing and below that the UCCC is only triggered when there is some personal repayment obligation on behalf of the borrower is simply incorrect. Third, and perhaps most importantly for purposes of this case, this court confronted a very similar question in Cash Now in 2001 and said expressly that the definition of debt under the UCCC does not include the requirement of repayment. Now, petitioners in this case want this court to say that that passage was either wrong or should be ignored. But that was a very important piece of the reasoning of this court in that case. For one thing, the fact that the UCCC does not define loan in terms of the requirement of repayment is precisely what distinguishes Colorado's UCCC statute from many other state statutes that define loan more narrowly. Petitioner has cited many cases from jurisdictions such as Michigan, New York, Florida, Texas. All of these jurisdictions more narrowly define loan as requiring an absolute obligation to repay. Colorado does not include that definition. Additionally, this court found persuasive in Cash Now the income tax buyers versus hand case. In fact, it was the only substantive case that this court relied on for its conclusion. Now, the Ham Court actually addressed precisely the argument that's at issue here. The argument was, what happens if a lender removes recourse provisions from its contracts? If it does so, may it escape regulation under the UCCC, income tax buyers versus Ham is a UCCC case. The court said no, the UCCC can't be read so narrowly, and in fact, to do so, to allow this easy evasion, would, quote, emasculate the regulation of credit under the UCCC. Now, the remand proceedings in Cash Now, in fact, demonstrate precisely that. On remand, Cash Now argued that whether or not it could be subject to penalties for transactions in which recourse existed, it had reformulated its contracts, removed the recourse provisions from them, and argued that it should therefore be exempt from penalties. It argued this to the court in a hearing, and argued it in briefing, and the hearing transcript for that argument is attached to the motion for partial summary judgment is in the record. The district court in Colorado said no, that does not allow you to escape the UCCC and impose millions of dollars in penalties on that company for all of its contracts, including those that lack resource.
Let me just interject, if I may. You talk about what other states are doing, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Pennsylvania, look specifically at this type of arrangement. So I guess I find myself wondering whether this is not something that would be better addressed by the legislature. Can you respond to that concern?
Yes, Justice Hood. That argument was precisely made in Cash Now and this court rejected it. The same argument, the Court of Appeals said, if tax refund anticipation loans, which the plaintiffs in that case called purchases, are to be regulated under the UCCC, the General Assembly should act. The point of the UCCC is that the General Assembly has acted, and it wrote that statute broadly enough to ensure that the new consumer products that come into the market and gain prevalence ought to be regulated under the same consumer protection rules as more traditional forms of credit. The whole point is that contracts shouldn't be drafted cleverly to escape regulation under the UCCC. The General Assembly has already made that argument. Now, several states have actually addressed this industry, including the UCCC states, and have decided to regulate it differently. That's Maine and Oklahoma, I believe, are two UCCC states that have decided to pass statutes regulating this industry. I think that just goes to illustrate that the UCCC does, in fact, regulate in this area. And in fact, the Maine statute explicitly says these transactions are not loans under the Maine UCCC. So I don't think you can say that these transactions, because not specifically mentioned in the UCCC, require additional legislation. Now, I want to address, I think, what is the crux of the petitioner's argument in this case, which is the very same argument that the parties made in the Cash Now case, and that is that this transaction is not a loan, but is instead a sale. Now, first of all, calling something a sale is probably the oldest trick that lenders use to avoid regulation. We saw that in Cash Now. We saw that in the Ham case. We saw that in Apple Auto Cash in Oklahoma, where a lender called a sale leaseback of a car a loan. We saw it in 1835 in the U.S. Supreme Court involving the quote-unquote sale of an annuity where the court said that, you know, clever distinctions and writing a contract so as not to require personal payment obligation doesn't take it outside of the definition of a loan. The reason that these contracts aren't loans is that the rights of ownership do not change hands. With lawsuit loans, and the agreements, in fact, disclaim this notion, petitioners can't step into the shoes of the plaintiffs in these cases and get their asset from the defendant. The only rights they have are the rights against the tort plaintiff, and that's the same right that any creditor has against a debtor. Pay me my money when my loan comes due. Now, petitioners cited what they called limitless examples of transactions falling under the UCCC that don't belong there. True sales, they're right, true sales don't fall under the UCCC, but true sales will involve at least some transfer of ownership. Let me give you an example. The sale of a promissory note. If the new owner of that note takes full rights in the note and can enforce that note as the initial owner did, that is a sale, not a loan. Now, if all that occurs is that a lien is taken on the proceeds of that note, that's a loan, and that's exactly what happens here. A lien is taken on the proceeds of a lawsuit. Sales of structured settlements. Mr. Dunn mentioned this in his opening argument. If you look at the structured settlement statute, it actually contemplates sales. There again, they have to be approved by the court, and numerous other procedural protections have to be satisfied. But if the sale is of the full rights in the structured settlement contract as opposed to a lien against the proceeds, that would be considered a sale. And the distinction is ownership. That does not occur here. The Allstate versus Medical Lien Management case, I think, illustrates precisely this point. And I understand the court did not decide whether the assignment of proceeds in a lawsuit that has yet to arise is or is not valid. I understand the court didn't decide whether personal injury lawsuits may be assigned under state law. But what it did say is that when a lender attempts to take an assignment of proceeds that have yet to arise, that assignment is not valid as against the promisor's obligor, here meaning the tort defendant. All that arises is a promise by the plaintiff to pay money to the lender once that money is obtained through settlement or judgment. So again, this just illustrates that the right that the petitioners have is a right against the tort plaintiff for payment, not a right of ownership in a lawsuit for the lawsuit proceeds. The next argument that I think petitioners make here is that this is not a loan, but is instead an investment. Now, Webster's International Dictionary defines investment, I think this is a common definition, as the expenditure of money for income or profit. So what that means is that investment involves putting money into a thing or purchasing a thing, expecting that thing to earn money as an income or appreciate over time. So that could be a commodity such as gold. It could be the part ownership in a business that's expected to earn money over time. It could be the purchase of real estate that is either expected to appreciate in value or earn rents over time. That's not how these transactions work. The only thing that grows over time in these transactions is petitioner's debt, and it grows according to the terms of the contract that petitioner's right. The asset itself can't grow. Torts are by their nature, torts lawsuits are by their nature backward looking. They compensate an injured plaintiff for either past or current injuries. So there's no way that what petitioners doing are investing in an asset that's expected to grow. It simply ignores the reality of how those transactions work. The UCCC itself recognizes this distinction, and it's in the definition of business or investment purpose in the definitional section of the code, which talks about investments meaning future financial gain rather than present personal or household use. The loans in these cases aren't used for present personal or household use. They're not put into a business that's expected to earn money over time. They're not even put into the lawsuit. They're put into the debtor's daily bills. And that brings me to sort of the last point about this argument. From a lender's perspective, every loan is an investment. That's true of a bank who issues a loan to a prospective home purchaser. And the bank expects a certain rate of return in response to the risk that it might bear for that transaction. The same is true for higher risk loans, such as credit card debt. So the fact that the petitioners want to describe these transactions as investments doesn't mean they're not also loans.
Well, I think I heard an argument that a lawyer can advise on these contracts, and so that takes care of it. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. Oftentimes, the lawyers aren't required to advise, but lawyers are already part of these transactions because these plaintiffs are represented by lawyers. And if you look at the record in this case, one of the underwriting features that petitioners require of these loans is that not only do these plaintiffs be represented, but that their attorneys be paid on contingency fee rather than hourly rate. And if you want to know why that is the case, it's because they want the lawyers to have skin in the game and seek as large a judgment or settlement as is available under the facts. So that's actually just a feature of underwriting of these loans. It's not a consumer protection feature. And certainly the UCCC would remove protections from a consumer who's represented. It's just not how the UCCC works.
Okay, so can I just follow up on that? Your opposing counsel argued that actually these sorts of transactions are very good for consumers. Can you just directly address that?
Yes, Your Honor. The answer to that question is that the General Assembly has already struck the balance between credit availability and consumer protection. That's the whole point of the UCCC. These transactions very well might be good for consumers. In some cases, they might be bad for consumers. If you look at the Odell case from North Carolina, there the debtor borrowed $3,000, ended up settling the case for only $18,000 and owed over half of that settlement to the lawsuit lender. So it's possible these transactions are good for consumers in some instances and bad for consumers in others, but this court doesn't need to address that. All it needs to do is apply the UCCC, which strikes that balance that the General Assembly saw fit for it to do. Your Honor, one of the last points I want to make is this notion of contingency. Petitioners have argued both here and below that these can't be loans because there is a contingency involved. These loans are contingent in the same way that every non-recourse loan is contingent. Repayment depends on the value of the asset at the time a loan becomes due. Now that was the decision in the Odell case. That case explicitly addressed this argument about conditional repayment as opposed to absolute repayment, determined that these transactions ought to fall under North Carolina's regulations that govern lenders and other consumer transactions. That point was also addressed in the Knight bankruptcy case, which we cited as supplemental authority recently in the court. The fact that these were contingent contracts didn't mean that they were sales that fell outside the scope of the bankruptcy. They are indeed of debts, and that's what the Court of Appeals observed when it cited Blacks and said that a debt can be contingent and still be a debt. So the fact that there is some risk of non-payment here, of course, would exist in any non-recourse loan. A reverse mortgage lent into an area like Arizona at the time of the housing crash certainly would be a very high risk loan that wouldn't somehow transform that transaction into something other than a loan. And there's this thread through some of the cases, and this is in the Rankin case, and I think in one of the Florida cases, that perhaps these transactions could be loans if the loan occurred at a certain time during the course of the litigation, or depending on the claim, for example, if it was a strict liability claim. That would turn the UCCC's definition of loan on technical distinctions of court procedure and cause of action, which is exactly the opposite of what the UCCC was designed to do. So, Your Honor, what we're requesting you do in this case is simply affirm that cash now meant what it said. The payment or advance of money to a consumer with the expectation of repayment is a loan, regardless of the loan's repayment terms and regardless whether the loan includes non-recourse features. So we ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and remand this case to the district court for disposition of the petitioner's remaining defenses and imposition of penalties in the permanent injunction. Unless there are no further questions, I'll see my time.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Yarger. Mr. Dunn?
So allow me to introduce, respond to a couple of those points. First, I think it's most telling what Mr. Yarger didn't say. And what the administrator hasn't said throughout this entire case, all the way back to trial, and that is, what does it mean to create debt? Because that's the operative term in the definition of loan. They have not provided any definition of what it means to create debt. And I understand why, that's difficult to do. And I think, however, this court did that, right? I think it was one of the more articulate ways of doing that. In all these cases we've read around the country, regarding these type of transactions or any type of loan. How do you decide when something is a loan and, or whether it's not? And the court answered that in passing. It said there has to be an absolute right to repayment from one source or another on the part of the lender. Justice, with regards to your comment about the legislature, you were exactly right. This is an issue for the legislature, as they've done in the types of transactions we talked about, whether they're lottery proceeds or viaticals or structured settlements. I believe 5 or 6 states have regulated this industry, and Colorado can do exactly that. That's a public policy debate that's more appropriate for the legislature than in this country.
Council, can I quickly follow up on that? To the extent that other states have attempted to regulate this, what exactly have they done, and how would they impact your clients if your client was subject to those states?
Right, so I'm not an expert on what every one of those states says, but in general, I think they do have some disclosure and limitation requirements, attorney advising requirements. In Colorado, obviously, they require the other types of transactions we talked about require court approval. I don't know if any of those other states require that, but I think they vary from state to state to some that are more supportive of the industry and others that are more restrictive.
Could I just follow up on that? Along those lines, though, to getting back to your question that you started with here, how do they limit the definition of debt in such a way that we know who's included and who's to be regulated?
In those states?
Yes.
They don't. What they say in those states is that it, some of them, as Mr. Younger said, I think it was Maine or Nebraska, for example, said it's not a loan. It's just a regulated transaction. They don't have to define debt. They just say if you want to engage in providing consumers with funds and purchase their potential litigation proceeds, you can do that under the requirements. Mr. Yara talked about the cash out control that says the code does not require repayment. So what the court was referring to there, and again, it's important to understand the context of the case was all about whether or not an absolute obligation of repayment was required. And again, because that's sort of a universal rule in the larger loan context, that loans require an absolute obligation of repayment. The only question was, well, did the UCCC broaden that, or did the court appeals apply that too narrowly? And the court went through the court wrote out the definition that's in the UCCC to make the point that there is no express language requiring repayment. By that, they meant absolute repayment. That was the issue in the case. Was a contingent obligation okay, or was an absolute obligation required? And the only point there was to say no, an absolute obligation of repayment wasn't required. Mr. Yara talked about a lien on proceeds. I don't think I referenced that earlier, but think about what that means. In the transactions where there is only one asset, the potential litigation proceeds, and he's saying, well, you put a lien on that, it's really a loan. I think the point there is to say it's security for a loan. Well, how does a loan work, right? A loan requires a personal obligation, and then often there is a security asset that if the person fails to breach the contract to pay the loan, they can then tap the security asset. In this case, the potential litigation proceeds can't be both repayment and security. That's just simply a non sequitur. You can't have the same asset be both.
Mr. Dunn, you need to finish up.
Okay. I'll stop there.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Mr. Dunn and also Mr. Yarger. So the court will be in recess till 1:30. Thank you.